I'm Rick Haro, and you're listening to Foul Ball, the future of the Marlins in Miami, a roundtable on the Marlins stadium deal. First, a quick disclosure. I used to be in the business of doing these kind of stadium deals. I developed South Florida sports facilities through the early 80s and coordinated national public-private partnerships for the 20 years after that, and I'm not in the business anymore and have not worked on the Marlins stadium deal. But this special aims at offering a balanced look at various perspectives on the Marlins stadium deal, but inevitably my years of experience will inform how I moderate this conversation. Moving on. It was 20 years ago this month the Marlins played their first game. The excitement and fervor among the fans at that time, a far cry from how it stands today. The Marlins stadium deal and the events that followed have perhaps irreparably damaged the relationship between the team and the community. But what was the deal history exactly? And does it really deserve the label like the biggest boondoggle in history? Joining me in studio this hour to discuss the history of the deal and distinguish fact from fiction, Miami Herald Managing Editor Rick Hirsch.
Hey, Rick, how are you?
Great. Thanks to have you here, and we appreciate it. And the Marlins say they needed the new stadium because Sun Life wasn't built for baseball, but the deal for the new stadium is a subject of constant controversy. Just to get the facts straight, what was the deal exactly?
Rick, it was a $632 million deal, and the Marlins put up less than one quarter of the money. The most came from Miami-Dade County, which put up $347 million in resort taxes and another $50 million from a bond issue. The city of Miami kicked in about $100 million more, including $90 million for parking garages. When the county and the city pay it all off, it'll cost more than $2
billion. Well, you know, that in and of itself is not that unusual given the national parameters of these kind of deals. But what was unique and unusual about this deal when it was made?
The Marlins have been a struggling franchise, and despite winning two World Series in their first 10 years, the team had been dismantled twice, its best players sold off, and the ownership group changed several times. The current group, which came in 2003, said the only way it could survive and have a big market payroll was with a big market stadium, and the public, and the county, and the city finally stepped up with real money.
Well, and to give some context to this special, we'll take questions from Facebook and callers from time to time. Nelson Gomez Jr. asks, the stadium's been built and done. Why are we still talking about this? And in fact, Barry Jackson and Doug Hanks had a great article in last night's Yesterday's Herald called Financial Mess at Marlins Park, Inside the Numbers. So, Rick, why is this deal still in the news?
A lot of people fought the stadium deal when it was proposed, but once it got approved, and once the stadium finally got built, there was a lot of enthusiasm around the team, and a lot of enthusiasm around the stadium. Even though the team played poorly last year and at times they were awful, people thought they had a commitment from the Marlins to spend money on quality players. The community built the team a stadium, and they expected the team to spend the money to build the team. The players didn't just set off the skeptics, who were angry all the time. It really angered the fan base, the folks who had been there even in the lean years.
Well, and for a full timeline of the Marlins' history leading up to the deal, you can go to WLRN.org and see a great interactive timeline put together by the Herald and WLRN, this and more. And Rick, a few weeks ago, Marlins owner Jeffrey Loria ended 3 months of silence and took out an ad in the Herald. Loria's ad also said the majority of public funding came from hotel taxes, so it was tourists, not residents, who were paying for the stadium. You politifacted this ad at the Herald. Is that claim true?
We concluded it was half true. First, you have to remember that you had $50 million in a bond issue that went towards this deal that specifically is from property tax players. It's true that resort taxes are paid mostly by visitors, but we also pay them when we go to resort hotels and have a meal. Our families and friends who come visit it pay them. But most importantly, the money that comes from resort taxes can be used in a lot of ways. It can be used on a baseball stadium. It could be used on a convention center. It could be used on the arts. And so it is public money that really needs to go to a public purpose.
Well, joining us by phone, a man who has been internationally successful as a businessman, but who also spent millions of dollars fighting the Marlins, Norman Brayman, joining us by phone. How are you, sir? You know, the problem is that I can certainly hear it. Now I can hear you, too. Okay. Let's do that again. Are you okay? Are you still
yes,
as good
I'm
as you?
Now I hear you now.
Are you still as good as you were when I asked the question in the first place? You okay?
I didn't hear. Yes, I'm fine.
Well, it's certainly in the news and will continue to be in the news. You fought the stadium deal, Norman, to the very end. You even led the recall effort of Mayor Carlos Alvarez. What galvanized you to fight this deal in the first place, Norman?
Well, I'm against the use of public dollars to enrich an asset of an individual or anyone that can basically afford to do it themselves. But let me say this, because I think there's been a misapprehension about my lawsuits and so forth. I never sued the Marlins. I brought suit against the county and the city. And what the Marlins basically did is what just about every sports team, whether it's the National Football League or whether it's Major League Baseball or whether it's even basketball, tries to get the taxpayers to pick up the tab and of their venue. So I my fault is not with the Marlins. My fault is not with David Sampson. It's not with Jeffrey Loria. My fault is with the politicians, the leadership of the community, of these communities that allow these travesties to happen.
Well, and Norman, we introduced you, and you didn't hear it, as a successful, you know, world-class businessman around the globe fighting this deal. But in fact, also, you tried to broker your own stadium deal when you owned the Eagles unsuccessfully. It's now been done as Lincoln Financial after the sale. But how is the Marlins deal different in your estimation?
Than what?
Than the deal that you tried to put together, or in fact the public-private...
Oh, we never asked for any tax dollars, and we never asked for legislation. We never asked for anything like that. What we explored was the possibility of building a stadium, and there was some property that was there that was owned by the city at the former football stadium sat on. But as you know, Rick, I fought you back in the early 80s when you were in favor, along with then Mayor Foray, to institute a one-cent sales tax increase to build a football stadium for Joe Robbie. And look what Joe Robbie did. He went out and built his own stadium with his own money.
Yeah, no, you've been remarkably consistent in all that. I understand that. I guess I just wanted to be clear that the Lincoln Financial public-private partnership in Philly that was done, admittedly, after you sold the Eagles, you would have been opposed to that funding plan as well?
Of course. The funding plan and what I proposed to do was to build a stadium privately. And I have no objection to help and assistance. And don't forget the help that the Philadelphia Eagles received, which was, by the way, given before I owned the team, involved a payback to the city. So it's the issue here. And don't forget, the issue here with the Marlins Stadium was a utilization of community redevelopment dollars. But you know, as I said before, the fault really lies with the politicians. Nobody asked to see a financial statement of the Marlins. Nobody asked Jeffrey Loria for his financial statement. In the same fashion that right now we're going through the same thing again. Nobody has asked the Miami Dolphins, who are looking for public dollars for their financial statement, or Steve Ross for their financial statement. And all the Dolphins want to do basically is what the Marlins did. They want to dip into public tax dollars as well.
So, Norman, we have a question that's consistent with that from Jose Gomez of Miami, and he asks, has anyone looked into the actions of public officials in both city and county, as well as the team and the lobbyists, to determine whether the deal was negotiated at arm's length or other undisclosed incentives? Do you believe that there were undisclosed incentives that were part of this deal as well?
No, I really don't believe that. I don't think any politicians were paid off or anything like that. I think that this is just the stupidity of our politicians with the active help of so-called economists. The economists, I was just going through some of the presentations. The economists estimated, by the way, that the Marlins Stadium would produce $480 million a year of economic benefits to the community. And by the way, this is the same economist that's been hauled out now by the Miami Dolphins to come up with the same type of figure of $500 million a year for the stadium improvements that they're looking for. So history repeats itself. And unfortunately, it's people outside the government structure that don't pay attention to this. For example, the Miami Herald backed the construction of the Marlins Stadium. The Greater Miami Chamber of Commerce backed the construction of the Marlins Stadium and are backing the additions to the Dolphins Stadium as well. And the same economist that did the economic forecasting for the Marlins has been employed to do the same forecasting for the Dolphins.
Well, we have
So this is something that just occurs. It's absolutely wrong. I mean, every independent economist says that these stadiums do nothing to stimulate the economy, but yet we don't pay any attention to that.
Well, we'll spend a little bit of time the second hour on that. Back to you in a second. We do happen to have the managing editor of the Herald here to talk a little bit about that perspective. Weigh in on that, Rick.
I have two responses to that, and hello, Norman. One
Hi,
is, first, I want to make clear that I oversee the newsroom of the Herald. The newsroom of the Herald does not set the editorial policy that appear on the editorial pages. Having said that, what Norman Brayman says is correct. The Miami Herald editorial board did support the stadium. The Chamber of Commerce did support the stadium. I think that is why there is so much blowback at what the Marlins did when they dumped players at the end of this season, because people felt they had been there, they had shown the support, they had not gotten that kind of support back from the Marlins.
Well, and the comment about the reaction, obviously, Norman, speaks to your issues. And you talk about blaming the politicians, the business group, the other side of the Herald, and others. How much do you blame Jeffrey Loria and the team for, quote-unquote, taking advantage of that situation?
You're asking me that question?
Yeah, absolutely.
I told you, they have done exactly what all the other owners, so many of the other owners, have done in Major League Sports. And, you know, so I don't really fault them. I honestly don't. I think the fault lies with the people that allowed this to happen. And that's the same situation in other cities. This is nothing unusual. You have situations in other cities where public dollars have gone in to build stadiums and commitments haven't been kept. But, you know, I disagree with one thing. I do not feel that the damage to the Marlins is irreparable. I think if the Marlins begin winning again, which is what the public basically wants, all this is going to be forgotten.
Forgotten from some, but not from you. Norman, thank you very much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
When we come back, we'll look at how the stadium deal has impacted South Florida politics, fans, and others. This is Foul Ball, the future of the Marlins in Miami. Be back in a couple. We're back with Foul Ball, the future of the Marlins in Miami. Rick Haro with WLRN, Miami Herald News. Even with the bad publicity from the deal, if the Marlins had pulled off an amazing season in the stadium, maybe everything would have been forgiven, but it wasn't. In June 2012, the Marlins were in first place. The ballpark drew fewer than 29,000 fans a game. And just to put that number in context, this was the lowest attendance for any new ballpark in decades. And on the politics front, most of the county commissioners who supported the deal remain in office, save Mayor Carlos Alvarez and Commissioner Natasha Cejas. What explains this result? We're going to look at the political and fan fallout from the stadium deal. Joining me now for a second segment, Rick Hirsch, managing editor of the Miami Herald, Patty Mazzei, politics reporter with the Herald. Rick, let's start with you pretty quickly again. When this deal was first made, the public reaction really wasn't that negative immediately, but when and how did things change?
Well, I think there was criticism of the deal from the start. But again, once the deal was made and the stadium was built, and more importantly, once the stadium was finished, there was a great deal of enthusiasm. It's a beautiful stadium. Baseball fans were excited by it. There was optimism about the team and the feeling that this franchise, which so often had big player turnover, would have a little bit more consistency to it. So people were looking for the Marlins competing. And I think they were surprised when that changed.
Well, joined now by David Sampson, the president of the Marlins. David, how are you?
Good. How are you?
Okay, getting ready for opening day, I know. And first question for us, I guess, $634 million in public money, brand new stadium. Less than 4 months later, the the team trades Hanley Ramirez, which begins a factually a 60% payroll reduction. Do you understand why South Florida believes that you betrayed a public trust?
Well, certainly I understand. And there's obviously a lot more to the story than what the numbers aren't exactly like that you're saying. I don't know that we have time to debate that in this forum. But the fact of the matter is that, of course, we're sorry that it all happened the way it did. It was just a very bad year off the field, and we could not sustain the payroll we had, and it was a bad year on the field. And so we really weren't left with any choices. But the ballpark is here for decades to come, and when you see something like the World Baseball Classic and other great events that are going on there, you realize that as the years and decades pass, this ballpark will continue to be sort of an iconic piece of Miami and will have a lot of good memories for people coming forward.
Well, and this is really not a debate of numbers. It's more of a comment on perception. The Herald had a poll last year that referred to the ownership group and Jeffrey Loria as being only above Fidel Castro as far as kind of a lightning rod in South Florida. And 98% of those who were polled say sell. I'm speaking about the perception now more than anything else. How do you overcome the cycle where 5,000 attendance projected of season tickets this year and people actually looking at a Groupon offer for opening day? We all understand there are a lot of reasons for where we are, but looking to the future, how do you overcome that catch-22?
Well, I think, again, it's a very sad for me. If someone's not going to come to a game because of Jeff or because of me, it's such a great ballpark, and it's Major League Baseball, and we're lucky to have Major League Baseball, and we're going to go out today at 1 o'clock, and we're going to compete and try to win as many games as we can. After having finished in last place for 2 years, we'd like to try to do better and build. But the fact is that all of the ticket promotions we have are like many other teams out there, as you know. You're just maybe only focused on Miami. We're trying to fill seats and help people be able to afford games with great discounts and great opportunities to have fun and make a memory. As far as anything else is concerned, all I can continue to say is I'm sorry it all happened like it did. I guess a lot of me wishes we had a $70 million payroll last year and a $70 million payroll this year instead of 100 last year and 40 this year. I think maybe you'd have a different show today. But that said, you can't change the past, and we went all in, which is what we said at the time, and it just didn't work on myriad levels.
Hang on 1 second, David. Let's get Patty's perspective. Forget the blame issue, but the article that S.L. Price writes in Sports Illustrated is interesting, and he points out that in 2012, the team followed a fail-safe marketing plan, a shiny new stadium, big personality manager, reality TV show, big-name free agents, but terrible season ticket sales and terrible ticket sales. What went on, Patty, in your estimation?
Well, I think there were several factors. Certainly Ozzie Guillen's comments to Time magazine about Fidel Castro probably hurt right from the get-go. I think the beginning of the sale of players in the middle of the season, kind of signaling at least to some fans, looks like it took it that way, that the team had given up. And I'm not a sports reporter, but it certainly looked that way from the outside. And also, I think it's expensive to go to the stadium. I mean, it is a brand new stadium, and so the food is better and the amenities are better than they were at Sun Life, but it's not cheap to take a family to go to a ball game. So I think all of those factors contributed just looking at it from the outside of the whole season.
David?
So I guess I would just add to that one of the things that I want to make sure all of your listeners are hearing loud and clear is, much like when you buy an airline ticket or check into a hotel, if you're paying rack rate, you're probably just not paying attention. So there's so many great discounts on Marlins.com, and Groupon is not something to be ashamed of. That's a business that people use. It's like saying that I'm flying using Priceline or Expedia, and I should be embarrassed to be on the same plane as someone paying, you know, a first-class fare. So it is actually very affordable. We let people bring food into the park, so we really we make it pretty easy. So in terms of Miami and in terms of entertainment, the cost for a family of four to come into a ballpark where every seat is good is really cheaper than going to the movies. So And we're trying to get the word out there for people to know that and see that.
I will say that Groupon has created some significant discussion over the past weekend for everybody. And from Patty's comments, David, the attendance from last season I know was disappointing for everybody. How do you explain it? Is it a collective perfect storm? Is it some of the comments that Patty talked about? Is there anything inherent about the South Florida sports fan from your perspective that speaks negatively about the future of baseball in town?
I hope not, but I don't know. And I don't blame anybody who doesn't come. I just wish everyone would try the ballpark once and realize that it's just one of the many entertainment offerings that Miami has. Again, we look at it from a long-term standpoint. I'd love to see what it would have been like last year if we had won and if Ozzie hadn't made those statements. I really would, but it didn't happen, so let's try another year where we can win and see if we can draw people. But those who did come to the ballpark really did enjoy it, and we're just trying to make it accessible for more people to try it and to make it something that they want to do during the summer when it's hot. Parking has not been an issue. Basically, it's a great place to spend a few hours, and we just want people to try.
David Sampson, president of Marlins, just a couple more questions for you. But before we go back, Rick, you're managing editor of the Herald, but you're also a longtime fan in South Florida. And so the big issue was timing from your perspective. React to some of these comments about the timing of all of this.
I'd say first, I bought the Groupon, David.
and he's not ashamed, by the way. He'll be on the plane.
You know, the timing's unfortunate, and I think there's an undercurrent here that has something to do with the history of the Marlins. I grew up in South Florida with the Dolphins, and you think about Dolphins players that you grew up with, and there are no players associated with this franchise save Jeff Conine who really have a history of the team, and that is a function of the sell-off after the 97 World Series, the fire sale, quote-unquote, of players. What happened after 2003's World Series and now this summer sort of continues that cycle. And I'm curious what David thinks about how you build a legacy and a fan base when there is so much turnover. And there are teams that keep players longer than the Marlins have.
David?
A couple of things. You're right. But I would point out that we had a pitching rotation from 06 to 12 that stayed together with Johnson and Nolasco and Sanchez each and every year. We had Hanley from 06 to 12. And every team maybe saved the Yankees and now maybe the Dodgers. You have windows. And so after 03, your Pudge left, but then in 05, we signed Delgado and still had the core of that team together. And we were favored to win again in 05 with Jack as manager. And we just could not do it in no matter what. We couldn't make the playoffs that year. And then we were forced to start a new window in 06. And then we started a new window for 2013 after having built payroll up from 2010. Sometimes the windows work and sometimes they don't. What I'm sorry for, though, is the perception that people have, correctly so, with how things have been with the Marlins. But I'll add, there aren't many players who stay their whole careers with one team. And when they do, it's noteworthy. The Derek Jeters of the world, the Cal Ripkins of the world, Mariano Rivera is noteworthy. You have players like Wade Boggs or Roger Clemens and Ken Griffey and A-Rod and these types of players who go team to team. Unfortunately, that's the way sports is. When I grew up, there were players who played on the same team forever, but my kids aren't used to that. With football, when they watch football, they don't see franchise players much anymore. Ray Lewis becomes an exception, not a rule. But I want to build legacy. We want players around for as long as they're good and as long as we're winning. But the key is to win more than to have a specific player. And so basically I'm apologizing not just for not winning, for not keeping the players, for not keeping what we thought we could do together for longer, and for not having the team we had perform better, all those things.
Well, your apologies seem to be consistent, and it is a new day. But reflect back, if you would, because I know you have to go watch opening day and cheer the team on. 4 years after the stadium deal was done, is there anything you'd have done differently?
You know, it's tough. 2020 is a setup question, right? Because 2020 is hindsight. Yes, we wouldn't have gone all in last year. We wouldn't have made the extra signings We would have stayed in the 70 million. You know, with the new ballpark, we wanted to do something extraordinary. And I think when you try for extraordinary, you risk failing. And we've never wanted to be down the middle, and maybe that's part of the problem with the ups and the downs of payroll and the ups and the downs of winning. But I'd rather have won a World Series in 03 and then keep trying to get another one than always be mediocre. And the risk of trying to be extraordinary is that sometimes it fails. And it's really hard to admit when you fail. Trust me, it's hard because you want to believe you're not going to fail. But we had to admit it, and now we want to keep trying, and we're going to earn fans' respect back one at a time. And I will just close, Rick, by saying I appreciate the opportunity to be on here, and I look forward to fans being able to enjoy baseball and not worrying about me or Jeffrey. And I understand what their views are of us. I really do. But long after we're gone, the ballpark will be here, and the memories they make with people they bring to games will still be in their heads.
Appreciate it. Final quickie for you. Are you in it? What do you say to the South Florida baseball and sports fan? Are you in it for the long haul? Are you evaluating this year's performance with a certain standard? What's your take on this year, given what happened last year?
Last year we were supposed to win 93 and we lost 93. This year we're supposed to lose 93, so let's see what happens. Redmond addressed the team before the game yesterday, during the last workout before the season, and he's excited. The players are excited. They don't focus on payroll. They focus on trying to win every game, much like the Astros winning against Texas last night in their home opener. You have to go out and play nine innings, and our guys are going to compete. We have a manager who's really into it and wants to win. These players are young and have a lot to prove. But you don't know. Am I in it for the long haul? I'm in it for as long as I'm to be offered a job. The president of the team is how long I'm in it. I'm honored to work in Miami and to do the things that we do in our community, and I love Miami and always will.
David, thank you very much. David Sampson, president of the Marlins. Appreciate it. You're listening to Foul Ball, the future of the Marlins in Miami. Roundtable special on the impact of the Marlins Stadium deal. I'm Rick Haro, WLRN, Miami Herald News. You join the online conversation curated right now by producer Brian Finkel. Just go to WLRN.org, or you can tweet us at WLRN. Rick, the toxicity around the Marlins today, is it about the stadium deal or the fire sale?
I think it's clearly about the fire sale. The stadium deal was an old conversation. Once the stadium opened, most people were talking about being excited about the team and having some big names here and finally having ownership, putting a product on the field that they could rally around. So we wouldn't be talking about the stadium deal if not for the fire sale.
Jonathan from Miami, he's talking about being a ticket holder. What's your take today? Jonathan, you there?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead. Tell us what your perspective is.
I was a season ticket holder back in when we were at Sun Life. I will not step foot. I have not set foot, even if I gotten a free ticket. I did not go to the World Baseball Classic. I am a huge fan of baseball, coming from New York City and being a Yankee fan. And what David Sampson just said was ridiculous to me. The smugness of that ownership. Every time they get on the radio, TV, or it's amazing to me. And that's, I think, what's happening with us fans. What's happening now, and all, we are disgusted with the way they talk. We're disgusted with the way they view this thing. Their smugness is really what gets us. And I will not step. I mean, he's talking about the stadium is going to be there. We call it the UFO coming out of Little Havana. I will not step foot in that stadium as long as that ownership is there, whether they win or lose.
Jonathan, really appreciate that. That intensity, you hear it all over the place. And Patty, Jeff Hinson also asks a question which kind of ties into this. Please ask politicians that supported this fiasco how they feel about their decisions now. I've done this around the country numerous times. I've never heard this intensity ever. What's this all about?
Well, you know, I think it goes back to the recall of Mayor Alvarez, who you spoke about earlier, the county mayor. That anger has not subsided, I don't think, as much as we expected it to. And the fire sale, like Rick said, really contributed to that. I think maybe we would see less anger in the polls and things like that if that fire sale hadn't happened, if people could kind of put that behind them. By the same token, however, those were kind of the only people who lost their jobs because of this, you know, Carlos Alvarez and the recall of Commissioner Natasha Cejas. No one else has. And so why would politicians be going out and speaking regretfully about their decisions? I mean, you had four county commissioners up for reelection last year, and they got reelected. Certainly the Marlins and the Dolphins helped in those reelection efforts. They put money, I mean, $150,000 to several political committees to help them out. But, you know, you don't see the anger directed to a particular commissioner for their single vote.
And Dade County Mayor Carlos Jimenez, City of Miami Mayor Thomas Regalado, biggest critics of the stadium, even made their careers based on it. And they probably need the stadium to do well economically. What's the relationship now, Patty, between the city, the county, and the team?
It's a strange relationship because they need it to do well, like you said. I mean, the county has said repeatedly, okay, now that it's here, let's make sure that things happen. So has the city, but you have a city that during the entire first season of the stadium, when it was likely going to be the highest turnout of fans, didn't lease the commercial space in the parking garages, losing money there. Now you have the city asking for back rent payments for the garage because the Marlins were storing materials there during the off season. And you have the county and the city mayor both walking this fine line where they want the stadium to do well, but then they go to Sports Illustrated, like the article you mentioned by S.L. Price, and saying things like, you know, the residents of Miami were raped by this stadium. So, you know, it's a little tense.
Janet from Miami, you have a perspective. What is it?
I think that just the dislike of the whole situation, that has nothing to do with the fire sale or anything else. That was taken to a referendum. People voted against paying public money for a stadium, private stadium, and the politicians bamboozled it down our throats. Then you had Samson on TV saying, if you don't give us a stadium, then we'll leave. Hey, don't let the door hit you. Honestly, I personally am one of those people who will never step foot in that stadium. Ever, I would always look at it with disgust and pain. I used to look at the Orange Bowl with pride, with nostalgia, with something that I grew up with something that represented something, at least a winning season. But it doesn't matter if they win or not. They shafted us, and that is the bad taste. It doesn't matter whether they win for the next 5 years straight. There's still a distaste.
Patty,
for the owners, for everyone.
Thank you, Janet. Patty, more intensity. What's your perspective on that?
Well, they never did put the stadium to a referendum. That deal was not something that the voters got to have a say in, which is why now County Mayor Carlos Jimenez is pushing for a referendum for the Dolphins to get renovations to Sun Life. So it wasn't like there was a public vote and the politicians ignored it. You know, it's intense. I do think that for a lot of people, if they field a winner, they will go. And obviously not the last two callers, however.
Yeah, obviously the last two callers are a little bit different. Rick, before we take a break, any comment on all of this, including the incredible intensity? I'm sure there are a lot more callers who feel just as intense, Lee.
Well, I think that's the blowback. The blowback from the deal where people thought they put the money up. The community made a long-term commitment. The commitment from the Marlins that they expected was something longer than half a season or just one season that went wrong.
Grant has a perspective on this. Grant, Miami, what do you have to tell us? Are you there? Grant? Okay. Grant probably, he talked about season ticket holder purge, but we talk about it in many different ways and much intensity about that. So the bottom line of all of this is an incredibly intense blowback, as everybody said. Patty Mazze, Miami Herald, thank you for joining us. Coming up, we'll look at how the stadium has affected the host community of Little Havana. Full foul ball, future of the Marlins in Miami. Be back after a minute. I'm Rick Caro. Welcome back to our roundtable special on the Marlins stadium deal. The new stadium was touted as a development that would help spur on more growth in the working-class neighborhood of Little Havana. But the low turnout and empty retail space in the parking garage, it doesn't look like much has happened. Joining me now, Fernando Gonzalez, director of Vecinos en Acción, a social services organization that's been in Little Havana for over 20 years. Also with me, Bill Fuller, a principal of the Burlington Group, a developer who works in Little Havana and co-founded the Little Havana Merchants Alliance. Of course, Rick Hirsch back here for the duration. Rick, what were some of the claims about the potential benefits to Little Havana?
Well, there was a lot of optimism. I should say there was a lot of spun optimism about what this stadium could do economically for the region, the area around it. The parking garages have substantial retail space. The politicians said that would create new business in the area, you know, and it's nice to think that a baseball stadium will revitalize a neighborhood. But there isn't a place in the country where that's really happened in and of itself. A baseball team plays 81 games a year locally. That's hardly enough to sustain a retail or a restaurant business.
Fernando, have you seen benefits to the community from the new stadium?
In my opinion, I don't see any benefits.
Why not?
Because first, the people who live in the neighborhood, they live in a very low level of poverty. So they cannot go into the stadium because it's expensive for all of them. Second, I don't see before when we had the Dolphins, we have 70,000, 60,000, a lot of people going over there, beautiful bands, you know, very attractive, everything. But right now, that's not many people going to the stadium. The stadium was built in a place is not attractive for the fans, really. How you say before, the parking places are also cost a lot of money, and the people, they don't want to park on the street because it's a hot neighborhood. I live over there since 1960, so you can imagine how I know the place. For the business around the stadium, 81 games, another matter is, who is going to bring another type of show to that stadium? Because the neighborhood, how I tell you, it's not a good neighborhood. And there we have the Miami Arena, many places in the town that the shows can be present. So, the stadium was built by the best opinion and propaganda of the Cubans politicians. I am also Cuban, but I can say that, you know, they convince everybody that the stadium has to be built in the place, and they bring the stadium. I was a lot more involved in that. And now what?
Well, let's put it in perspective with some objective property value analysis, Bill. What's been the effect of the new stadium on nearby property values?
Well, first I just want to say that the stadium really is not coexisting with the neighborhood. There's no dialogue between the Marlins, the city of Miami, and the neighboring properties. It continues to serve as an island that was dropped, a beautiful modern structure, and all its facilities dropped into the middle of Little Havana. The dialogue between the community and the Marlins has not really existed. The retail, tens of thousands of retail, remains vacant since I think they've had 3 years to lease it. Originally, they were trying to attract top-tier national tenants that have clearly passed on those opportunities. And I think it's time for the Marlins and the city to wake up and to recognize that if they need to start listening to the community, and the community wants local retail, they want to empower our creatives, they want to empower our local entrepreneurs to create real, authentic businesses. I can tell you that the area that I'm developing in and around Southwest 8th Street, 15 blocks to the south, has seen tenfold tourism increase, 3 million from 300,000 over the last 9 years. The neighborhood is thriving. Our businesses are exciting. The push from downtown and Brickell expansion is pushing into Little Havana stronger than ever before. And I think the Marlins and the city have missed the boat. And I think it's time for them to step up.
Well, a follow-up on that, because nationally, these kinds of facilities in outlying neighborhoods, let's call it, take a while to catch on and do their development synergistically. Is it that it'll never happen? Is it that won't happen in the time frame that the expectations delivered on? Or is it a combination of all of that?
It definitely will be, but we have to be realistic about the types of tenants that are going to be drawn into these facilities. You're not going to be bringing in Hooters or Flanagan's into these neighborhoods right now. You need to bring in other businesses. I think there was an opportunity once to bring in a supermarket, and I think that didn't seem as an attractive alternative, but that would be a great option. At least we would stir business. We would have pedestrians walking in and around that area. And I think that there's a direct correlation between the types of services, retailers, restaurants that you have there and the type of community that builds around it. And I think that takes time. You're not going to build a Disney World overnight. And I think that was the expectation.
This is a roundtable special on the impact of the Marlins Stadium deal. I'm your host, Rick Haro, WLRN Miami Herald News. Tell us what you think by tweeting us at our handle at WLRN, or you can join the online conversation at WLRN.org. We have a caller, Principal Alex Tamargo with the Metro East Charter High in Little Havana. Alex, you'll be principal of a new school next semester. Tell me about it.
Yes, hi. My name's Alex Tamargo. I will be the principal of the Sports Leadership and Management Academy, SLAM, which is located directly on 12th Avenue and Northwest 6th Street, two blocks east of Marlins Stadium. It'll be a sports leadership charter high school, actually charter middle high school, servicing students from grade 6 through 12. And there's been an overwhelming response to our school because we have a capacity for 980 students, and currently we're over 1,200 applications. So it has been a really big draw from this community.
Now, from your perspective, the kids get to shadow Marlins execs, so you're bullish on this process, right?
Yes. Basically, we've been dealing with the Marlins. We started this year, and our students get the opportunity to volunteer and intern during game days and shadow the Marlin executives for all the behind-the-scenes entertainment-type stuff that take place during a ballgame.
Thanks very much, Alex. One man's opinion. There's a perspective there, but you know, Rick, you've mentioned the lack of community benefit from this deal isn't really the fault of the Marlins. It's the fault of the governments, in particular the city of Miami. Why?
Well, I think this is one of the areas where the deal the city and the county made wasn't as farsighted as it might have been. It seems like sports teams have much better lawyers and negotiators at the table than local governments tend to. It would make sense in a retail space like the spaces in the parking garage to have a business like a Subway or fast food places, but you don't have those in this place because that's counter to the deal. The deal was not to enable people to buy food on their way into the stadium, even though they can bring it if they have it. Those things would draw people more from the neighborhood. There was talk when this first started that they were going to bring a Banana Republic into the retail space outside the stadium. I mean, that doesn't really pass a straight face test.
Now, Bill from Burlington Group, who's here, would probably argue that you can't mandate development in a certain area, and you refer to the fact that the Marlins may have outlawed the city in this context. What do you think the city could have done to protect the development aspect of this? Rick, you first, and then Bill, go ahead.
Well, the city could have negotiated better terms and more flexibility for itself.
Yes. Yeah, Bill, what do you think?
I also believe, from my understanding, I don't know the terms specifically of the deal, but I know that there were also restrictions put on zoning outside of the development that they created, so that there were restrictions on the types of bars and other types of commercial developments that could be done. I really believe that a lot of this development on the commercial side should have happened organically. It should have happened from the private market, and should have been done to create really unique concepts. And I think there was a total disconnect there, and there continues to be a disconnect. I mean, where are the answers? Where are the tenants? Why are they not renting? What are the limitations holding us back from getting those spaces occupied in our neighborhood?
And Bill, we have a Twitter question. What kind of business do you think should be near the stadium?
I think that a supermarket would be great. I think it's an asset that's required on that side of the street, on 7th Street. I think that there's plenty of businesses I deal with all the time that are looking on coming into the neighborhood, being close to downtown, local service businesses that are ready to service the Brickell downtown downtown market, small eateries, all of these things. I don't mind. I'm very, very proud of our entrepreneurs, very proud of what we have in Little Havana. And I think that I would love an opportunity for all of our stadium attendees to experience the best that we have to offer on the streets, on 7th Street and that area around the Marlins Stadium.
Well, Fernando, you said a few decades. I remember going to the Orange Bowl when I was in high school, which is thousands of years ago.
Beautiful.
And we all remember what it was like to be part of that experience. Do you think the Orange Bowl process was the right process? Do you think this Marlins Stadium will ever live up to expectations about the development of the area, or is it just going to take some time, or will it never happen?
Well, let's say that in Little Havana, every day a lot of tourists going to see the Domino Park and a lot of places. No one going to see the stadium. Another matter is by the 7th Street, to rent a place to have a business in the stadium. Across the street is the Robert King High buildings where elderly people live. So nobody walk around there someplace. If you have in mind to put a business over there, what do you sell that are going to attract the people to come to shopping or do business over there? There is nothing. I believe maybe an sports store or something. Another matter is the parking place, and it's a very busy street, you know, the 7th Street. So I don't think to risk money to put a business on 7th Street and in the Marlins Stadium has to be good thinking about it.
Maybe master planning development issues, Fernando mentions. Rosibel in Miami, you have a comment for us?
Hi, yes. I was wondering about the residents of Little Havana and the parking challenges that they're facing as well, in addition to what I heard about the towing and towing fees and having their vehicles impounded once the stadium was open. I know it's a working class neighborhood, so probably most people can't afford to deal with, you know, this kind of cost. So I'm wondering what's being done to deal with that. In addition to the fact that, you know, most of the jobs went to non-locals, most of the construction jobs and the greater traffic issues that they're facing now. This is still an issue that they have to deal with as long as the stadium is there, I would think.
Rosibel, two separate questions, 35 seconds to answer it. Rick Hirsch.
The parking question is an interesting one. Back in the day, people parked in people's front yards to go to the Orange Bowl, and they didn't play 81 times a year, but when they did, it meant a lot of money to people who lived in the neighborhood. Now, they're the big parking garages. The give back was supposed to be development and jobs. That hasn't happened, and people aren't getting the revenue from the parking like they were. So there's a lot of angst in the neighborhood about how this stadium has changed that dynamic.
Let me tell you that I live three blocks far from the stadium. I live in 18th Avenue between 2nd and 3rd Street. Before, the people who live in the neighborhood had the opportunity when the Dolphin was there, you know, and the Hurricanes, and to rent their empty places on their yards. I used to rent part of my house, my yard, you know, for the cars over there. We can make some profit and try to survive with that. But right now, that doesn't work.
Bill, 10 seconds.
Yeah, sure. I just want to say real quick that there was a study done in the late 90s. It was in-and-out traffic of the stadiums around the United States. The Orange Bowl had the best in-and-out. They built, and we had 75,000 stadium goers. Now we have 37,000. I think the Marlins need better dialogue with the community. I think that they should open their stadiums in the interim to let residents use their parking garages when they're not using them, not behaving the other way, restricting the residences.
Thank you all for joining us. Rick Hirsch, Miami Herald, Bill Fuller, Burlington Group, Fernando Gonzalez, Vecinos in Action. Stay tuned for our next hour. take a look at some of the underlying questions that come up in a discussion about the Marlins Stadium. Namely, why governments are in the business of funding not only pro sports facilities, but performing arts centers, museums, and even hotels. And we look at how the Marlins deal shaped the conversation about Dolphin Stadium renovations and how the Marlins deal compares to other sports deals. That's coming up next on Foul Ball, a roundtable special on the Marlins Stadium deal.